This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli from Broadcasting and Cable Magazine and TVWorthWatching.com, sitting in for Terry Gross. Our guest is soul singer Bobby Womack. He started singing gospel in the mid-1950s with his brothers. After they were discovered by Sam Cooke, they started recording soul music under the name The Valentinos. One of their records, It's All Over Now, co-written by Bobby Womack, was covered by the Rolling Stones. Womack went on to a solo recording career and also had some success as a songwriter. He wrote several songs for Wilson Pickett, including I'm a Midnight Mover and I'm in Love. Womack wrote and sang the title song for the 70s action film Across 110th Street. That song was used by Quentin Tarantino in his film Jackie Brown and, more recently, was also heard in the film American Gangster. The collection The Best of Bobby Womack, The Soul Years, has recently been released. It includes this 1971 hit.
You know, life is funny when you look at it. Everybody wants love, but everybody's afraid of love. You know, I'm a true believer that if you get anything out of life, you got to put up with the toils and strife. Now listen. Ooh, you're pushing my love a little bit too far. I don't think you know, I don't think you know how blessed you are. And your friend Annie Mae tell you all she see. Have you ever thought you were trying to get close to me? Yeah. Think it over. Think it over, girl. And if that's been weak for you, I don't mind.
Terry Gross spoke with Bobby Womack in 1999. She asked him about Sam Cooke, who discovered Womack and his brothers and was the first to record them and give them their big break.
Tell me about the first time you heard him sing in church, and I think this was in the early 1950s.
It was in the early 1950s. He had just joined the Soul Stirrers. And it was strange because the guy that was this lead singer of the Soul Stirrers, R.H. Harris, was Sam idolized and worshipped the ground he walked on. And that's who he was trying to sing like. So R.H. Harris started to give him voice lessons and work with him. But R.H. Harris was like Rudolph Valentino. He had a woman in every city. And in every city, he also had kids. So it got to a point for child support, he couldn't perform anywhere because they would pick him up and take him off the stage. So it was really weird. So he says, I can't go out anymore. I don't know why he was able to stay in Chicago. Would it be because he didn't have no kids there? But anyway, he got Sam. Sam was 16, 17. And he said, this guy's got to replace me because I'm hurting the group. And Sam came in and took over. He took over so fast that it seemed like the people forgot about Harris. And Sam came to Cleveland to perform with the Soul Stirrers, and we were trying to get our break. In other words, if we could open up for the Soul Stirrers, at that time it was like opening up for the Rolling Stones. And all of the old guys in the group says, no, let them come back when they grow up. We're professionals. And you guys, y'all nice, that's cute, but this ain't no place for kids. And Sam said, what do you mean no place for kids? And he said, it's going to be a place today. And not only that, I want your mom to find the biggest purse she possible find. And we ain't singing until y'all take up an offering for them. And I never forgot that.
You once said that the first time you saw him perform in church, it's like he's fixing his hair in the middle of the concert.
And, oh, yeah.
And the women are going crazy.
He would say, wonderful, God is so wonderful. And he would just, I said, look at this guy. Women are going crazy. That was like a rock and roll show. So the older people didn't like it. They say, we don't think that they should play with God like this. I say, look, the Bible said make a joyful noise. You don't have to be under some spell to shout or cry and jump up and dance. I think it's great to see kids dancing off records, whatever. If they're dancing, they're respecting God. And they're showing him their love. So that's what it's all about. So the gospel is the truth. You just have to broaden the scope of it, and it can go as far as you let it go.
Well, Sam Cooke not only let you sing when he performed, he later signed you and your brothers to his recording label and produced you first singing gospel, but then singing rhythm and blues. Now, Sam Cooke, I think, was an inspiration to a lot of gospel singers because he crossed over from gospel to pop and made it really big. So,
and everybody was afraid to do that. Even Sam was afraid to do it.
How'd you feel about making that transition?
I was scared to death because everybody was constantly saying, Sam is not going to have any good luck because he sold himself out to the devil. And he was singing for God. Now he's worshiping the devil.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the way we were taught. And I was watching, saying, when is something going to happen to him? You know, and as soon as he had a car wreck, that was a warning. Then if something else happened, they would say, God's punishing him. I said, I don't know that kind of God. Those things just happen. And sorryly, he did leave here with a death you would never expect. But today, I mean, you could be walking down the street and somebody shoot you for snoring or talking to yourself, you know, so it's crazy. But it was then that was like Sam wasn't a violent kind of person, and he died of a bullet, been shot by a woman.
Your father sang gospel. He sang with a group called Voices of Love. How did he feel when you and your brother started recording Rhythm and Blues?
He was very, very hurt. It broke his spirit. I remember he was so hurt that he told us, he said, all of you guys got to leave this house. You got to get out. You're not going to sing it in here. So he put us out. I quit school when I was about 16. And Harry was 14. He quit. Cecil was 13, and he quit. And my other two brothers had finished. And so we told Sam, he put us out. He said, where are you at? I said, we're standing on the corner. And he says, oh, God, man, I didn't want to cause that kind of problem. But he knew, because his father was a preacher. Mm. He said, I know what you're going through. He said, I just hate this responsibility. He said, do y'all know how to drive? I said, I got temporary license. And my oldest brother got license. He said, okay, I'm going to send you some money to buy a car. And y'all get on Route 66 and do not get off Route 66 until you get to California.
Is that what you did?
I was supposed to go buy a new Chevy station wagon. But all of the hustlers and the pimps and the fast street people had the big Cadillacs. So I said, I can't buy no Cadillac with this car and go to California, too. So I told my brothers, and instead of getting a new car, let's get this old Cadillac. It looks good. So they say, come on, Bob, let's do what he asked us to do. I said, no, let's get this Cadillac. And so I said, the Cadillac only costs $600. We got $2,700 left, you know. So they said, okay, so we bought this Cadillac, and the first thing I want to do is drive back on the school grounds and talk to my history teacher who always told me I would be nothing. He said, you're not going to be nothing but a janitor. You always talk about y'all going. So we used to go sing, and my father would drop us out the next morning. We come from Florida. He'd drop us out right in front of the school, and we're already an hour late, and we're running trying to get into school. And the kids were laughing, but he would always make a joke. One might go to the board, who invented a cotton gin or some question like that. I'm looking for some girl. Tell me. Help me, please. Yeah. All right, write it 5,000 times. And he was always, so this guy, his name was Mr. Washington. I said, I got to drive back before I go anywhere. I drove on the school grounds and blew my horn, and everybody came running to the one. It's Womack. I said, yeah, that's where I got my start. Got me a caddy. You know. So he kept telling the kids, get away from the window. And the strangest thing happened. The car cut off and would not start. And, man, I'm praying to God, Jesus, please let this car start. I just want to get off the school grounds. He said, I'm going to call the police if you don't move the car. And it finally cranked up. And I got it home. We left that night going to, on our way to California. My mother was crying. She was worried. She packed us a big lunch. My father probably was sorry that he had pushed it to that point. But he was a very stubborn man. He wasn't the kind of guy to give in. So he says, he didn't say anything. And we took off driving. A week later, they were still looking for us.
Where'd you
Sam
end up?
Say, well, we went to hospital because we were overtaken by gas fumes.
Oh, gosh.
It started to rain. We cut on the windshield wipers. They went straight off the car. And we kept filling the car up about, it seemed like every hour we had to put gas in the car. Gas, the tank had two big old holes in it. All the tires blew out, every last one. It was really crazy. So when we got to Hollywood, California, we were pushing the car down Hollywood Boulevard.
Well, so you finally made it to Hollywood in this really bum car that you spent your money on.
Oh, man,
and hooked up with Sam Cooke. Now, before we hear something that you recorded with your brothers produced by Sam Cooke, I want to just backtrack a second and play something that you recorded with your father, since we were talking about him and his reaction to your crossover.
I hope you play the song I think you're going to play.
Tarnished Rings from 1976.
Yeah, that's a
this
great
is a
song.
Great recording.
Great song. And I heard his voice the other day. It scared me to death because I drive his car right now.
No,
that's
really?
My favorite automobile. It's 1974 Buick. Just like it was when he drove it off the floor. And that was the car I purchased for him. That he said, if you ever do anything and you ever make it out there, he said, you could buy me a deuce and a quarter. So I said, well, deuce and a quarter? I didn't know what a deuce and a quarter was. I said, yeah, I'll get that for you, Pop. But when I did make my first piece of money, I said, I'm going to get my father that deuce and a quarter. And I asked somebody, what's a deuce and a quarter? They said, he must be from back east. So that's a Buick. I said, is that what he wanted, a Buick, not a Cadillac? No, he wants a Buick. So he had that Buick, and he would never let me trade it in. So when he passed away, I restored the car till it's original, just the way it was originally. And I drive it all the time. It feels like when I start it up, he starts up.
Right. When did he pass?
The other day, that song, I forgot I had a CD put in it, and that song just came on. Tarnished Ring scared me to death. I thought my father was in the car. I said, oh, God.
Well, let's hear Tarnished Rings, recorded in 1976. This is my guest, Bobby Womack, with his father, Friendly Womack Sr.
You know, people always ask me, Mr. Bobby, where did you learn how to sing like that? Well, I think I'll let y'all in on a little something extra. I want you to hear my father sing this particular song. He's
well, I sang a ring that never graced a finger. Dime store trinkets made of glass and tin. And how we cling faded dreams that linger. Fancying the past can live again. Tarnished ring and imitation jewelry. Foolish things I cannot leave behind.
All right, Dad, my turn. For this ring and imitation jewelry always bring you back into my mind. When I was young, I thought all...
It's Bobby Womack and his father, Friendly Womack Sr., recorded in 1976. Let's pick up where Sam Cooke had signed you and your brothers, and after recording a few gospel sides, you started to do rhythm and blues. You were, you know, performing, I think, on stage with people like Sam Cooke. I think the Valentinos opened for James Brown, didn't you?
Yeah, we opened for James Brown. We opened for Solomon Burke. We opened for the Falcons, who had Wilson Pickett as their lead singer at that time. Eddie Floyd.
This must have been something different for you than singing in the church.
Well, it was different because the women could come in many dresses and whatever, and... you didn't have a pretty woman backstage in church, you know. They caught the service and they went home.
Did you
then
go wild?
I could take them home.
Right.
Then I go wow. They called me Wild Bill Hickok. Yeah, but I tell you, and something like when you first get it, I mean, you basically sing 70% of the audience is women.
Mm-hmm.
But after being in it for 10 years, you adjust and you find out this is going to be happening every night. You know, you better get used to it.
Let's get back to Terry's interview with singer Bobby Womack. His CD collection, The Soul Years, has just been released.
I'd like to play what's probably the best-known song from the early part of your career. This is a song you co-wrote. It's called It's All Over Now, which was covered by the Rolling Stones after you recorded it with your
brothers. They just did a commercial on that again.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, tell me a little bit about writing the song. Do you remember writing it?
I remember I had an uncle, his name was Uncle Wes. That was my father's youngest brother. And he was in love with this woman named Betty Jo. But Betty Jo was going to church with him and Dad all the time. And she was a pretty lady. And one day she just said, enough is enough. And she started going to nightclubs and hanging out. And she used to wear these long dresses. And then she took a dress up to her past her knees. Uncle Wes could not control it. So every weekend, he didn't know where she was. Nobody knew where she was. They knew she was out having a good time. And she'd come in, but he'd be talking about, I'm leaving Betty. This is it. No, it's all over now. It's all, I swear it's all over now. Soon as Betty Jo came in the house, was like, well, stick to your guns. Don't. She come in there, and she said, how you doing, honey? No, you got to get it. I got your bags packed. She said, come here a minute. She take him in the other room. We never understood what happened. But he go in that room. He never came out. I didn't know if they were dead, but the next morning, he'd be unpacking her bags. We said, Uncle West, you fell for it. So I said, next week when she go out this week, don't go in the room when she comes back tight. Hold on to the couch. We'll help you. He kept saying, you don't understand. I said, no, I understand. Just don't go in that room. So the same thing applied again the next week. And she said, come here, West. And so he'd be telling her, no, it's all over now. So that's how the song came about. But I used to love her, but it's all over now. And I didn't know about, because I wasn't too young to fall in love. I was 15 when I wrote the song, but just thinking about it, that's where the song came from.
Well, let's hear It's All Over Now, recorded by the Valentinos, which is the Womack Brothers.
The Womack Brothers.
My guest, Bobby
call
Womack.
Call us in church. The Womack Boys.
My guest, Bobby Womack, is singing lead on this 1964 recording. That's Bobby Womack and his brothers, who were known then as the Valentinos, recorded in 1964. So what was your reaction when you found out that the Rolling Stones wanted to record your song?
I was very upset.
Why were you upset?
It's because, as far as I can remember, that every time a black artist came out with a song, you know, segregation was everywhere. It was in music and everything. So they would say, we can't let that record be played on pop stations, which were white stations. So we would get a Pat Boone, somebody to take the same song and sing it, which the white audience never knew it was sung by a black artist. The same with Elvis Presley songs. You know, it was written by a lot of black artists and sung by most black artists. There was hits on the black side of town. On the white side of town, it was a whole different thing. So when Sam came to me and said, Bobby, it's a group called the Rolling Stones. And I said, yeah, that's nice. Hope they keep rolling. He said, no, what I'm trying to tell you, he said, they like your song, and they want to sing your song. They want to record it. I said, man, let them get their own song. I don't want them to sing my song. And he said, you don't understand. They're going to be huge. He said, Bobby, Rolling Stones coming whether you like it or not. And he said, and plus, I own the publishing. He said, I'm trying to tell you that this is going to be a career move for you. I said, yeah, but, Dad, this is our first break.
Did you like their version of it?
Well, I didn't like their version because I didn't think Mick Jagger, until the day I said Mick Jagger can't out-sing me. Yeah. But when I saw that first royalty check, I liked their version.
Right.
Much. I said, good God almighty. Now, I said, man, I could go back and buy Cleveland.
let me ask
so
you about...
So I've been chasing them for the past 30 years, saying, just do one more song. If y'all do one more song, man, I'll retire. To be saying, Bobby, you started us the writing. Because Andrew Odom says, Bobby, when you quit that song, I told him, I said, if you want to be the Beatles, you can't keep taking songs from other people. You got to start writing your own songs. They said, we can't write. He said, yes, you can write. And he was the sixth stone, really.
Bobby Womack, speaking with Terry Gross in 1999. His CD, Bobby Womack, The Soul Years, has just been released. This is Fresh Air. I'm David Biancooley, in for Terry Gross, back with Terry's conversation with soul singer Bobby Womack. When we left off, they were talking about cover versions of his records. His song, Looking for a Love, was covered by the Jay Giles Band. Let's listen to the version Womack recorded in the 1960s with his brothers, the Valentinos. I'm
Now, that session was produced for Sam Cooke's record label. Sam Cooke was killed, shot and killed in 1964, and I know that changed your life in every way. I mean, he was your close friend, your close musical associate. And then you became became part of his family in a way.
I married Sam's wife.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of people, I mean, I think I must have invented the tabloids because, I mean, they ate me alive. They called me the boy that married Sam Cooke's wife. And I was saying, I got to cut some hit records now because I want my name back, Bobby Womack. And I figured out a way I could take that as through song. You know, it was trying to compare me with Sam, but it wasn't Sam. And I still say today, I'm 55, I was 19 when I married her, that I married her because I saw a move going down where it was separation between the two. Sam played around a lot. People talked and said, don't let her know the business. Don't let her know anything about it. She'll be the first one to divorce you and you'll be broke. And he used to always say, I said, Sam, why don't you get a will? And he said, a will? He says, Bob, if I made up a will, my wife would kill me. He said, Oscar, I have to play around. I love women. And that's just my nature. That's just part of me. So he said, but if I should die, he said, bury me deep and put two women on each side of me. And he would always laugh. And I said, I don't find that funny, man. I think, here's the guy, I mean, I'm 19 and Sam was about 30, you know. And so he thought it's funny. He said, I'll tell you what, you be my will. Something happened to me, you take care of my family. And he would joke like that. But I took him very serious. So soon as that happened, I started being a detective, walking around saying, hey, I know where the money's at. I know what bank it's in. I know this is this. And he also owned this. He owned that. What is the publishing? And I taught him the publishing. So you're saying
you didn't feel like you were betraying him in any way?
No, I wasn't betraying him. I was doing just what he would have done if he was here.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
I said, I will make sure that she's in a position. I told her, I said, I don't love you. She said, she's the one said. It was like the graduate. She said, marry me.
Mm-hmm. Now, you were also really well known as a session guitarist in the 60s and 70s. And I want to get to an example of your session work and a very kind of famous Wawa guitar line that you played for Sly and the Family Stone's recording Family Affair. Where did you learn to play Wawa guitar?
Well, I just, I play upside down. I'm a left-handed guitar player. My father was a guitar player, and I learned how to play. I taught myself. And I don't want to make it real short. I'm not going to deviate. I'm going to talk a long time. You want to edit me. That's it.
The end.
That's the end. All right. That's a good one. I'm good for me.
Now, I know you knew Jimi Hendrix. Did he teach you anything guitar-wise?
No, because we both had two different styles. Even though he was a left-handed guitar player, too. Jimmy was a very gentle guy. Very gentle and wanted to help everybody, was easy. I mean, Jimmy would walk around a roach. And normally you see a roach crawl and you just step on him. You know, he was just a nice guy. And Jimmy played different. He could play the way I played, but he also had his style. His style was hard driving. He used to stand up to the... I remember when he used to set his little guitar on fire. He had bought a Sears and Roebuck. And then he would jump on it with a blanket and put it out. By the end of the week, keep doing that to the guitar. It looked like it had been somebody tried to barbecue it. And he said, one day you're going to hand me a line of guitars. He said, I get so engrossed by it, and I climax. And I want to climax so much, after the guitar's on fire, I just want to cut it and burn it. And then after I get through burning, break it up, bust it all over the stage and walk off.
Did you think he was crazy doing that to his guitar?
Well, because I've been in show business, I just figured he's just come from another angle.
Right.
I thought he was different. I said, boy, he's weird. I said, I would never put my set no master on my guitar.
Well, let's hear
it. But now he had so many guitars, he finally did work it out where he could just burn them every night.
Well, let's hear you on guitar, wah-wah guitar, on this recording of Sly and the Family Stone's Family Affair.
Somebody that just loves to learn, and another child grows up to be somebody you just love to burn. Mom loves the both of them, you see it's in the blood. Both kids are good to mom, blood's thicker than the mud. It's a family affair.
That was Bobby Womack on guitar. Now tell me, you know, wah-wah guitar ended up sounding so dated after a while. Like, was there a time when you said, okay, it's over for this style of playing?
The guy,
I'm not going to do it anymore.
The guy that had the name for wah-wah guitar, was the guy's name was Wah-Wah. And he played wah-wah on everything. I just played wah-wah on that song because I was trying to create something, so I said, hey, Sly's never used the wah-wah. I'll put the wah-wah on it. And we was in the studio, and we were just, like, hanging out, and it came out that way. But I didn't play wah-wah on everything. I didn't even like it. I liked it on that song because it just sort of fit with grace notes that he was playing on keyboards.
My guest is Bobby Womack. Now, I want to move on to another of your many great records. And this is Across 110th Street, which you wrote as the theme for the movie of the same name, which starred Anthony Quinn and Yaphet Kotto. And this was one of, like, the great action films of the early 70s. How much of the movie had you seen before you had to write the theme song for it?
I saw the movie all the way through one time.
Did you like it?
I loved the movie, but I felt that the company really didn't want to let me do the... And I was going to go on tour the very next day. They said, you got to have the score done in 2 weeks. You know, and that's... But I couldn't... But what they didn't know is that whole story was about something I lived all my life, the ghetto.
Mm-hmm.
So I said, I could write this song and just keep elaborating on it and do other songs without ever seeing the movie again. Because everybody told me, said they should have given you TV... edited version down so you could look at it and you could set the song tones to, you know. I didn't get a chance to do that. And plus, when you're touring and hitting one-nighters every night, I was surprised that I came off with what I did. And I had to record it, all of this in 2 weeks. I went to muscle shows and cut everything and got the tape back, and the guy said, that's incredible. Boy, if we would have given him the time that he needed. No telling what would happen. I said, probably the same thing.
No, I'm not sure it would have gotten better than this.
No, I don't think it would have gotten better because I think I'm better when I'm under pressure.
Mm-hmm. Let's hear your recording of Across 110th Street.
Of a fire, doing whatever I had to do to survive. I'm not saying what I did was all right. Trying to break out of the ghetto was a day-to-day fight. Being down so long, getting up didn't cross my mind. But I knew there was a better way of life, and I was just trying to find. You don't know what you do till you put under pressure. Across 110th Street is a hell of a tester. Across 110th Street, pimps trying to catch a woman that's weak. Across 110th Street,
That's Bobby Womack's theme from Across 110th Street. You must have been pleased when Quentin Tarantino used this in Jackie Brown to open the film.
Yeah, because, you know, I used to date Pam Grier.
Oh, wow.
That was Rosie Grier's ex-Rams. That's his niece. And so he introduced me to her after me and Barbara divorced. And he says, hey, man, she's a beautiful girl. And she was saying, I'm going to be a star. And she was real wild, but she was real positive. I mean, she would get anywhere, and anything she wanted to do, Pam Grier found a way. So I've had her singing on Across 110th Street. Now, the most incredible story about that is that about 7 years ago, we did an interview. We hadn't seen each other in years in New York. And we were doing, she's asked me, what was I doing? And I was telling her, well, you know, just working, doing the same old thing. Things slowed down quite a bit. But, you know, something new happened, and I always do. And her thing had slowed down from doing her black exploitation movies. And but if I could have told her then, a couple of years from now, you're going to be starring over people like, she would have thought I was crazy. And that song would bring us both back.
Bobby Womack, speaking with Terry Gross in 1999. By the way, Womack's song Across 110th Street was also used in the recent film American Gangster. The Best of Bobby Womack, The Soul Years, has recently been released. Carole King's Tapestry was a dominant album in 1971. It held the number one slot on the Billboard charts for 15 weeks, selling 24 million copies worldwide in the next 6 years. King won 4 Grammys, including Album of the Year and Song of the Year. Tapestry was reissued recently in a form that critic Milo Miles says may be its finest presentation yet.
Time does strange things to classic pop albums. Some, like the Beatles' Sgt. Pepper's and Pink Floyd's Dark Side of the Moon, fly along on autopilot, famous for being famous. Others, like Michael Jackson's Thriller, are tarnished by forces outside themselves and may take a generation to recover luster. Others are simply invincible.
When you're down and troubled,
the only negative you can say about Carole King's second solo album, Tapestry, is that she's never made anything as good since. But few performers have. 1971 was a landmark year for women's pop music, which also saw the release of Joni Mitchell's moodier, darker masterpiece, Blue. But Tapestry was the monster success, selling millions and winning awards. And it should have, because it answered a burning populist need. Joni was a rarefied creature. Carole King was telling everybody what it felt like to be a modern, self-assured woman and a grown-up woman at that. The supremely adult reflections of It's Too Late and You've Got a Friend enrich the anxieties of Will You Love Me Tomorrow, originally a trembling teen anthem.
Tonight you're mine.
That version of the song appears on the second disc of the new expanded edition of Tapestry. Except for the weakest, most passive track, Where You Lead, the entire album is reproduced with previously unreleased solo acoustic versions recorded at 3 1973 concerts and one from 1976. This turns out to be a brilliant repackaging, though not in the way I initially expected. Not having heard the studio Tapestry in a while, I remembered it as being overproduced. Not because too much was added, but because the proceedings were too smoothed out. I hope the solo versions would correct that. And a couple times, they do. The new treatment of So Far Away is more fervent and soulful than the original.
So far away, doesn't anybody stay in one place anymore? It would be so fine to see your face at my door. It doesn't help to know you're just time away. Long ago I reached for you and there you stood. Holding you again could only do me good. Ooh, how I wish I could, but you're so far away.
But listening to the remastered Tapestry, it's impossible to deny producer Lou Adler did a visionary job. The sound is casual but focused, flowing but precise. The open mood underscores King's determination to state herself forcefully. It's a style that would be widely imitated in the 70s. And I agree with liner note writer Harvey Kubernick that you can hear echoes of Tapestry in current performers like Tori Amos and Alicia Keys. Adler must have a special feel for this material because he does a fine job of explaining how the new presentation works. He first heard the songs as potent demos and built the sound of Tapestry up from those. Inevitably, King and her piano became a bit less central. So, including solo performance versions of the tracks, as Adler says, allows the listener to hear the songs as they were first presented to the producer and then go back to Tapestry and follow the process to the production of the final album.
Looking out on the morning. To feel uninspired, and when I knew I'd have to face another day, Lord, it made me feel so tired. Before the day I met you, life was so unkind, but your love was the key to my peace of mind. 'Cause you make me feel like a natural woman.
And it works. Listen to the live versions first. Then, even if you felt burnt out with the studio album, you will hear it with fresh ears. All previous versions of Tapestry should be rolled up and put into storage.
Milo Miles lives in Boston. Whether fairly or not, George Carlin's name will always be associated most closely with his routine on seven words you can't say on television, which he first performed more than 35 years ago. Our linguist, Jeff Nunberg, has these thoughts on how our attitudes about profanity have changed since then.
The Appreciations of George Carlin described him as a counterculture comedian. But the connection was really just circumstantial. Carlin was no hippie. Actually, I don't know that there were any hippie comedians apart from Cheech and Chong, or I guess maybe Sonny Bono if you want to push the point. Long hair and beard or no, Carlin was really the last hipster. The sardonic tone and scat riffing went straight back to Lenny Bruce, Mort Saul, and Lord Buckley. And Carlin would have been the first to acknowledge his debt to Bruce for a lot of the elements in his routine on seven dirty words you can't say on television, like the ruminations on the grammar of profanity and the rapid-fire recitations of a string of dirty words like a kid pledging allegiance to the flag of some undeclared nation of the id. But it was Carlin's routine that entered American folklore and that stamped his identity as a performer. That's partly because Carlin's material was less confrontational and more ribald than Bruce's was. But it also reflected a cultural sea change. In their time, comics like Bruce and Saul were relegated to the category of sick humor. Bruce himself disliked the label, though he used it in the title of a 1958 LP. But whoever spoke it, sick implied a deviation from normality that required a special dispensation in the name of art. When Bruce was arrested for obscenity in New York in 1964, a group of cultural luminaries, including Lionel Trilling, Susan Sontag, and Allen Ginsberg, issued a manifesto on his behalf. True, they said, Bruce's routines sometimes made use of what they called the vernacular. But they defended the language as essential to Bruce's satirical intent and went on to compare him to Swift and Rabelais. Actually, the adjective Rabelaisian probably fits Carlin a lot better than Bruce. But by the time Carlin started performing his Dirty Words routine a few years later, public profanity didn't require an artistic justification. It was a form of social protest in its own right. There's a telling moment in the movie Woodstock when Country Joe and the Fish engage the crowd in a call and response of the F word. Give me an F, F, give me a U, U, and so on, and then launch into their anti-war, feel like I'm fixin' to die rag, the one that goes, it's one, two, three, what are we fighting for? The segue would have been bewildering a decade earlier, but by 1969, shouting the F word had become a gesture of political liberation. It wasn't just that the stigma of the word embodied American sexual repression and hypocrisy, but that those very hang-ups were held to be responsible for the injustice and violence of the American system. As Jerry Rubin put it, how can you separate politics from sex? Puritanism led us to Vietnam. That connection between sexual and political repression was at the heart of Carlin's seven dirty words routine.
You know the seven, don't you, that you can't say on television? Shit, piss, f***, suck a mother, huh? Those are the heavy seven. Those are the ones that'll infect your soul, curve your spine, and keep the country from winning the war.
At the time, in fact, some people were making those charges in perfect seriousness. After the Chicago police beat up demonstrators outside the 1968 Democratic Convention, Vice President Hubert Humphrey defended the police actions by saying, "The obscenity, the profanity, the filth that was uttered night after night was an insult to every woman, every mother, every daughter. You'd put anybody in jail for that kind of talk." But that was a more innocent age. There may still be a lot of people who are disturbed by the tide of ambient vulgarity that was loosed in the 1960s, but nobody's really shocked by it anymore. It's been quite a while since you heard profanity denounced as subversive, much less as an insult to American womanhood. And at a more enlightened age, we don't put people in jail for talking dirty. It's more expedient simply to allow the FCC to fine broadcasters who air language that the agency deems indecent, thanks to the 1978 Supreme Court decision that grew out of a daytime broadcast of Carlin's routine by a Pacifica station in New York. Carlin himself never stopped speaking blue to power. He kept reworking the routine over the years to increasingly universal acclaim. That testified both to his elevation to cultural icon and his perceived irrelevance in a world that was awash in apolitical raunch. After his death, he was even paid tribute by the director of the Parents Television Council, the watchdog group that was set up to orchestrate a deluge of email to the FCC whenever Detective Sipowicz spoke his vernacular mind or when Diane Keaton let slip an unacceptable modifier on Good Morning America. But then the battle lines are drawn very differently now. In its next term, the Supreme Court will be taking up broadcast indecency for the first time since its 1978 decision. Only this time around, the case pits the FCC against Rupert Murdoch's Fox Broadcasting, and the offenses involve expletives that Cher and Nicole Richie dropped during the Billboard Music Awards. It's sad to think that we'll never get to hear Carlin go to work on a lineup like that one. But I've got a pretty good idea which side he would have come down on in the end.
Jeff Nunberg is a linguist who teaches at the School of Information at the University of California at Berkeley.